When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Hey, everybody, it's Tim Miller from the Bulwark. Happy Thanksgiving. It's Thanksgiving, so we're going to do a little football and politics content. And I've got Seth Wickersham of ESPN with me. He's got a new book out called American Kings, a biography of the quarterback. We're going to get into that. There's some quarterback politics overlap, believe it or not. And Seth, I appreciate you doing it. This is kind of a No Kings podcast. We're going to do American Kings book for you.
I love it. And like, yeah, it's been an interesting time to have a book with that title. It's been an interesting year to have it. But, you know, fortunately, everything's turned out okay.
Well, for the book.
Yes.
Turned out okay for the book title. We'll see how things turn out for the rest of us. So I want to get into the book, but first we'll just do a little bit of, football and politics, mm-hmm. and where these things intersect. I guess just first, like, what's it like for you being you always got to be working on Thanksgiving. Like, are you just like away from family?
Yeah, it's, you know, not every year, but it's a lot of that. I think that like one of the most interesting kind of turns that football has taken, especially the past 10 years or so, but even moving more, is to own holidays. And so that means long days for a lot of people who, you know, end up covering things that are directly tied to the games or even adjacent to the games. But, that's okay. That's just kind of how it goes. But it's been an interesting twist. What used to be reserved for like the NBA and other, you know, the NBA All-Star game, like the NFL is just moving into those territories pretty ambitiously and ruthlessly.
Where are you at on this question of like, you know, mixing the politics and football and turkey and all together and jumbling it all up? Is that just like part of American life now? Because that's another thing that I feel like has gone on hyperdrive lately versus the old days.
I mean, I think it's all mixed. I think that like, you know, when people, you know, tiptoe around politics, you know, that's exactly what they're doing, is they're tiptoeing around it. And it's always easy to step on it if you want to. You know, it's been an interesting time. I mean, I think that like, you know, my job is to write profiles about interesting people and investigate the NFL about certain topics and issues. And, you know, at times, politics, especially President Trump, have overlapped with those things. And those have been really, really fascinating times to cover.
Yeah. One of those times, I just kind of the overlap of all this has been kind of interesting. Like in a way, NFL has been a kind of microcosm of the political vibe shift in the country from left to right. And I was thinking, you know, you go back to during COVID or after the Black Lives Matter protests, that you have like end racism in the end zones, which I want to end racism, but I found that kind of silly to some level. It's like, is the end zone paint really going to do anything on this? It felt a little bit like, not really a substantive effort to end racism, but, you know, it's on the helmets too. Mm-hmm. And you had that. And now like 4 years later, you know, we're having flyovers for Charlie Kirk and kind of like very over the top honorifics for him and, you know, Trump going to the games as somebody who's been covering that, you know, does that say to you that like the NFL team owners are like showing their true colors now? Does it say to you that like these guys are going to jump on whatever the hot fad is of the moment? And, you know, if the next fad is Bernie and AOC, they'll pretend like they're socialists. Like what do you think's happening?
Well, they are socialists in one very important regard, and that's the NFL, because it's run incredibly like a socialist organization where, you know, really you have some of the most ruthless capitalists, you know, that our country's produced who adhere to a very socialistic structure. And so that, of course, is very interesting. But, you know, I think that like one thing I've learned covering the NFL for a couple of decades now is that it's never proactive necessarily about these items. I think that like it's, for better or for worse, it's usually reactionary. And I think that like, you know, I covered in depth with my colleague Don Van Natta when President Trump came after the kneelers in 2017. And that really threw the league and the ownership, which had really kind of enjoyed a status that was almost like above the political fray. It really threw them into a lot of debate. You know, there was a lot of sharp elbows thrown. There was a lot of hard feelings, and there was a lot of discussion that really lasted over the course of a month about how to handle this particular issue. And, you know, it brought out some interesting colors in people. Like when we reported that Bob McNair, the owner of the Texans, said, you know, we can't have the inmates running the prison, which is, you know, of all the pieces of reporting that I've had over the years. I mean, that was one of them that we reported on that really transcended the sports world. You know, I think like what we're seeing now is the league trying to do its thing, trying to remain above the fray. But obviously, when moments call for it to intersect with the president, you know, they do it, and they do it, you know, pretty respectfully. You know, but we'll see, you know, how that goes. I think that like Trump really hasn't, you know, concerned himself too much with the NFL. Obviously, he was really critical of the kickoff rule, which the special teams coach for the Kansas City Chiefs ended up saying this week, you know, had some pretty pointed comments about that. My colleagues, Don Van Natta and Adam Schefter.
Was he pro? Was he on the Trump side of it or on the other side?
To paraphrase, he said the president has no idea what he's looking at. Okay. That's true. But, you know, my colleagues, Don Van Natta and Adam Schefter, reported that, you know, Trump wants the new Washington Commander Stadium to be named after him. But, you know, and then there was the Bad Bunny stuff that kind of came up and disappeared. So I think that, like, you know, I'm loath to like say that the NFL has like some sort of sophisticated plan about how to deal with the president who can be, you know, let's just say atypical and impulsive at times in terms of who he picks to comment about. But, you know, so far it seems like it's worked.
For the league. Yeah. I mean, you do see, and like, and the owners are malleable. I mean, look, I worked with Woody Johnson for a while, the Jets owner, who was a Bush guy who went all in with Trump, like, you know, which I saw no signs of, besides him being a Republican. He had nothing nice to say about Trump, let's just say, when me and him were hanging out during the campaign. And you see Harris, the Redskins owner, who had been a Democratic donor, who was, you know, at the MBS ball, I guess, because, you know, he's part of the deal with the new stadium, need Trump. So, like, a lot of this stuff is just transactionalism, I think, from a lot of these owners more than ideology.
Yes, and that encapsulates NFL owners better than anything.
Yeah, right.
Like, transactional over ideological, that's it.
I did just want to highlight your point about the NFL being socialist. It is such a true point. And as a kind of former Republican and somebody who's on the free market, I'm like always on this against the owners. And I feel like it's because I recognize this. Like, it's like, it's kind of like a bad, well, some might say all types of socialism are bad, but in this case, this is a particularly bad type of socialism because you get like all the benefits of it without any of the responsibilities like to the community. I guess, like, for years, the Nuggets and Avalanche, this is not out of your sports league, like, did not, their games weren't on TV in Denver, and because they're in some pissing match with the TV networks, Comcast, and I was like, this is insane. I was like, you guys have an obligation to the city. Like, you get this. This is not a free market. Like, you're not in a free market. Like, there are only 30 teams. You get gifted one of them. You get these huge profits on the back end. Like, you need to have an obligation to give it back to the city and not just to do, you know, like these, whatever, have a couple of charity functions with the Boys and Girls Club and call it good. Like, you have a bigger obligation than that. And it does feel like a lot of times the owners don't feel that way.
Well,
don't demonstrate that.
Yeah, or they feel like they've done enough. I mean, again, it's like NFL owners are kind of a strange and fascinating breed. Like, in one sense, like, if you look at the votes that they take on issues, concerning the league, not political votes, but like, you know, whether to change replay or whatever it might be, you know, almost all of the votes end up being like, you know, 31-1 with, you know, the Bengals abstaining. They're almost always like, we think about these guys as being kind of kings of their own castle and very independent thinkers, when in fact, like, groupthink usually prevails over league initiatives. It's very odd. It's very rare that they end up, you know, that these votes are actually really, really close. And, you know, knowing a lot of owners, I think that, like, when it comes to the community aspect, there's some of them that take it, you know, so seriously that it's like, you know, part of who they are as an owner. And then I think there's others who feel like that no matter what they do, no matter how much money they spend, you know, it's never enough and they're easy targets and they get kind of turned off by it all. And so, you know, sometimes I can see both sides of it. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, like you said, I mean, the owners are more transactional than anything else.
That's true.
In every way.
Some good community minded owners, just not the Kroenke family. Okay. The book I want to get to, I guess give us the big pitch for the book. Then I have a couple things I want to talk about.
Well, you know, so it actually kind of was rooted in a little bit of politics. Like, I remember seeing photos, you know, when you'd see presidents together. And I know that this seems really foreign to some of your younger listeners, but, you know, like President Bush 43, when Obama was being inaugurated, had every president over. And, you know, you look at them sitting around a table and it's like they know something specific about each other's life, even if they don't discuss it, because they've shared this kind of very unique experience. And being a little bit of a high school quarterback, as I was, I try not to come off like the Uncle Rico of Anchorage, Alaska, but being a little bit of a high school quarterback as I was, I realized that, like, there's something different about this job. It is different than anything else in really global sports, in that you have to wear all of these different hats and so many hopes are kind of ascribed to it. And it's not a job you play. It's, you know, you don't play quarterback, you are one. And so it takes over the identity of these guys. And I really wanted to take a look at, like, what it's like to do it in high school, now and throughout history, college and now and throughout history, the NFL now and throughout history. And then finally, like, what it's like to be retired and kind of having hardwired yourself to survive a certain winnowing and ringer and live with that the rest of your life. I mean, those are the things that kind of fascinated me with it.
Yeah, I do wonder the quarterback thing, the best example, I think, of how it is different and how it's a specialized knowledge that some of us who are on the outside are trying to understand and translate is the Mannings. And obviously these guys are really in my face living in uptown New Orleans. But at some level, like, you know, and Peyton, like, for me, I have pretty good familiarity with all of them, being a non-sports person. I mean, Peyton played for the Broncos, my team. Eli was the next door neighbor of my best friend at Ole Miss. I now live in uptown New Orleans, so I see them all around. And, like, none of them are physical specimens. You know, none of them look like, oh, you know, it's not like you get it when you see them. And you see some people and, like, think of them, like you see Aaron Gordon on the street and you're like, that dude is that dude is an athlete. Like, I remember seeing, like, some of the Broncos guys, Carl Mecklenburg, I got walking around town. It's like, that dude has legs that are like tree trunks. It's like, none of the Mannings look like physical specimens, particularly Arch, not, you know, any different. And now, you know, you have this three generation thing happening where now Arch is going into Texas and he seems to have kind of figured things out after a rough start. And now Peyton's kid is 14 years old or whatever. And I'm already seeing clips of him going around. And it's like that, the fact that this family has some secret sauce leads you to think that there's something there that's more than just like raw physical talent.
Totally. And I think that, like, is it nature or nurture? Like, that's the most interesting question. And I think that, like, there's a lot of mystery to it, but it isn't a coincidence that this is the hardest thing to do in sports and that one family has seemed to do it at a level that, you know, few individuals can do, to say nothing of a collective. And, you know, I wrote about Arch. I spent a lot of time with Arch and his high school when he was at Isidore Newman his last year. And I wanted to write about his recruitment because, first of all, like, his recruitment was the most intense of any player in history, definitely since, you know, the social media age. And so I wanted to, like, get into this and all the symbolic value that it displayed, but also just, like, try to use him as a window to show the Manning family and to try to get out like why these guys are so good at this thing that is so difficult. And I think you're right. Like, you know, look, they're blessed with some genes, clearly, but like, you know, like Peyton Manning is lucky in the sense that he's 6'5". But, you know, everything else, you know, I think that like there was an aspect of being obsessed and seeing where it could take it. But in the same sense, like there is some sort of natural ability. Like you have to be able to throw naturally at a certain level to play that well in the NFL, as Archie and Peyton and Eli did. And that to me was so fascinating about Arch, because he was kind of the reciprocant of all of this knowledge accumulated over decades, almost like bionically built in that regard.
Yeah. I mean, Peyton won his last Super Bowl at the Broncos with like a noodle arm. He had a dead arm. Mm-hmm. He was basically like me. Like, what do you think, talking to all these guys, what do they say? What is the intangible aspect of it? Because the other thing that is interesting is like at some level, you know, look, Caleb Williams, Arch, like people saw early on that they were going to be elite. But like when you get really down into the details, I mean, like look at how many just misses there are in the NFL draft, or like how bad people, you know, like you would think that like with all of the attention, all the resources, all the money, all the analysis that goes into this, you could like look at a 21-year-old and say, that guy's going to be good in the NFL. And it's still kind of 50-50, it feels like, is even with the first and second round picks. Like what are the people who are experts at it? Like, what do they say? Why is that? What is the intangible element of it?
I mean, NFL teams know more about the quarterbacks that they look at drafting than the American public knows about presidential candidates, which is insane, but it's true. I mean, they have more information than anybody else could ever need for a job interview. And yet, you know, yet they're wrong. I mean, you could walk into a draft room, look at 10 quarterbacks and pick one, and your success rate would be as good as just about anyone ever who's done this. And so, like, why is that the case? I think that like there's a couple of things. Number one is that like the college game is kind of played differently than the NFL, in the sense that like the hash marks, the little lines in the middle of the field, are differently spaced. So because of that, there are some really smart coaches who can create windows that are open in college that aren't open in the NFL. So in a real way, you can't like, it juices statistics. Like, you're a Denver fan. I mean, you're used to looking at the Rockies and wondering, like, you know, how good are these players? Because the altitude makes the hitters look better than they might be, and the pitchers look worse. Like, college is the same sort of thing, where it's like grade inflation only for quarterbacks when it comes to statistics. And then, so when they get to the NFL, you simply don't know whether they can make the throws into the windows that you need to in the NFL. And then I think the other thing is, like, context matters. And we don't like to think about that. Like, we like to think that a quarterback, like a great center, you know, can kind of scotch tape over everything and make everyone look better. But like, going to bad teams is a problem, and it ruins a lot of players that could be really good. I look at, when I wrote about Caleb Williams in the book, a lot of this news has gotten out, but like, it was about him and his dad and how they were weighing blowing up the draft, like John and Jack Elway did, and like Archie and Eli Manning did, because they didn't want to go to a team that had a horrible track record for offensive play and developing and drafting quarterbacks. And, you know, so a lot of the arc with him gets into that question of like the fact that, like, even though we don't want to admit it, you know, luck matters, employment matters, and context matters when we're evaluating quarterbacks.
Bulwark Takes is sponsored by Calm. There's a lot out there telling us how to be better. Be a better parent, better partner, better worker, better version of yourself. It's exhausting. When I need to hit pause and reset, Calm is the tool I reach for to release stress and find space to breathe, even on the busiest days. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, and it's here to help you feel better. If you're feeling like you could use some support navigating life's ups and downs, get the relief you need with Calm sessions. They include guided meditations to help you work through anxiety and stress, boost your focus, build healthier habits, and take better care of your physical health. Or sleep stories, sleep meditations, and calming music to help you drift off to a restful sleep quickly and naturally. The Calm app puts the tools you need right in your pocket, so stress and anxiety relief is always within reach. Calm has over 2 million five-star reviews and can help you stress less, sleep more, and live mindfully. Calm your mind. Change your life. Calm has an exclusive offer just for listeners of our show. Get 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/bulwarktakes. It's an amazing value. Go to calm.com/bulwarktakes for 40% off, unlimited access to Calm's entire library. calm.com/bulwarktakes and tell Calm you heard about them from me, the calmest person on the internet.
Yeah, coaching and scheme matters. And you mentioned in the book,
totally.
The Elway stuff is a great example. I mean, like he is a unique physical specimen in a way that the Mannings kind of weren't in a lot of ways. And yet still, like, he just does so much better when I'm growing up with Shanahan than like, mm-hmm. than previously with Dan Reeves, who's more of a defensive minded guy. So, like, that stuff does matter.
Totally. And like, I think that, like, look, I grew up some of my life in Boulder and I was a huge Broncos fan, you know, during that time. And like, you know, we use the term, and this is like even applicable in politics, you know, it's like, but you know, the system quarterback idea, which is like, it's about the infrastructure more than it's the player. And it's kind of a backhanded compliment when like every quarterback is a system quarterback. Look at John Elway's statistics under Dan Reeves and under Wade Phillips and Mike Shanahan. It's obviously there's a system component to it all. And so I think, like, you know, again, this doesn't lead us any closer to, you know, knowing how, you know, what that magic bullet is for drafting and developing quarterbacks. If I knew what it was, I would have flown down to New Orleans on my private jet, done this podcast in person, and then flown home. But, you know, I think that, like, all of those factors matter a lot more than we think they do.
What other, just come back to the quarterback stuff and the cultural political element that we were talking about at the beginning. You know, when I was growing up, up to not that long ago, like, black quarterbacks were really slandered. It was like in this context, mm-hmm. so like the American, like the quarterback position, it takes something special. It's like physical, but it's also cerebral, and there's intangibles, and you have to be able to have the intangibles to do well. And there's a, you know, just like a common slander in sports talk radio and in the ether that like black guys could not do that as well. It's like one of the last, maybe the last sports role where that was really the case. There are other places in society. You still hear that now, and some of the discourse from folks on the MAGA right about various things having black pilots or whatever. But what was the evolution of that? Were there any like key inflection points, and kind of where do you think, is that totally gone from the public perception, do you think, at this point?
I mean, I think it's mostly gone among NFL decision makers. I can't speak for like all fans, but I think that like it, and it's interesting because I mean, the NFL and the draft process was one of the few places where that kind of discourse was still allowed, which, you know, was really kind of embarrassing to think about. But like, that's where a lot of that stuff came from. There was one moment that I think is really important, and I wrote about this in the book, and it actually happened in Louisiana. There was this great quarterback at Grambling named James Shaq Harris, and he was there in the late 60s. So he's coming out for the 1968 draft, and he's seriously considering, you know, not playing professional football because he doesn't think he'll get a chance to play quarterback, and what's the point? And he meets with Eddie Robinson, who's the head coach at Grambling, brilliant man, very influential coach, one of the all-time, you know, college greats. And Eddie tells him, like, you know, if you don't do this, you know, you're going to be making it more difficult for people who come along later. But if you do it, you also can't blame the system because you know what that is going in. So you've just got to be better than all of this. And so Shaq goes, he got drafted by the Buffalo Bills. Their starter was Jack Kemp at the time. And he still didn't know if he wanted to go. Like, they were going to put him in the YMCA, whereas the rest of the quarterbacks were in a team hotel for training camp. And he goes to a park. And he blindfolded himself. And the big throw that the NFL wanted to see college quarterbacks make was the deep out. So he picked a tree that was about 20 yards downfield, and he blindfolded himself. And he was like, I'm going to throw at this tree, and if I hit it, I think I'm ready. If not, you know, maybe not. So he blindfolds himself. He throws, and he doesn't hear anything. So he lifts up the blindfold, and he sees the ball past the tree. So he says, well, maybe two out of the three here. But he goes and gets the ball. He drops back again. He blindfolds himself. He throws. And, you know, as he's telling me this story, the hair on my arm is standing up because I couldn't believe, you know, how much was at stake here. He hit the tree and he feels like, you know, I'm ready. And he goes in the NFL, and it wasn't like a direct path to success, but he ended up having some really good years. And he really, more than anyone, helped open the door for Doug Williams and Warren Moon and these trendsetters like Randall Cunningham, who came later, Vince Evans, and even people like Patrick Mahomes talk about Shaq Harris as one of those guys that history has mostly forgotten, but was one of the most pivotal quarterbacks when it came to, you know, introducing the idea that Black athletes could play quarterback at elite levels.
Yeah. And definitely Mahomes has sort of, I think, incinerated any concerns at this point, or Lamar Jackson and the folks we see in the NFL now. Jaden Daniels, my boy, Daniels, here at LSU. Unfortunately, we gave him a good system for the offense, but the worst defense in the history of LSU cost him what he deserved, which is a chance to be in the playoffs. All right. Well, I guess that's a good transition to how we're going to fix that, so LSU doesn't do that for our next great quarterback. We're without a coach. Politics is getting involved in that right now, as the governor, Jeff Landry, keeps interfering in the coaching search.
Right.
He's trying to recruit Lane Kiffin, who's the Ole Miss coach, that is in the middle of the season here, which is ongoing. Which is, just as a quick aside, I know you're more of an NFL man, but the way the NCAA is doing this is so stupid. Is there any way they can fix this? I like the idea that no other league has this, where you have this stuff happening in the middle of the year. They should just make a rule so the recruiting and the coaching changes and all this stuff happens after the season's over.
I mean, I think that to do that, you would have to admit. Look, I think that what we've seen in college sports the past 4 years or so is that a lot of the facades that were up there for the longest time, that this is amateur sports, that this isn't professional, that these are true student athletes, all of these things have all kind of come crumbling down. And I think the final one would be, admitting that this is professional sports and that, they need to be governed by a set of rules that are uniform across the country. And the college sports used to kind of have an association like that. I think it disbanded, I want to say in 1997, if I remember right. But they used to have something like that. And now I think you see calls for that again, because, look, there's a lot of things to love about college sports. There's a lot of things to really be disgusted by. But I think that one of the biggest ones is the fact that you can recruit players and actively be taking another job during the season while those guys have real careers and real futures and real livelihoods based on you. I think that that is really abhorrent.
Yeah. And that's really where we are right now. And that's why this stuff is it's so stupid, right? It's and I feel bad for the Ole Miss folks that are they're in the middle of this great season and their coach, yeah, Lane Kiffin, is coach of the season, I kind of understand Lane's perspective a little bit. I mean, some of the Ole Miss people are mad at him and saying, why would you abandon us at this time? But it's because of the way this dumb system is set up, all the other good jobs are going to be decided by the time the season is over. And so they've just really set up a really dumb way of doing it. But my hot gossip out there that does relate to your business is that Lane is not only considering Florida and LSU and leaving Ole Miss but he's interested in following Jackson Dart to the Giants. So do you want to break any news or reporting you have on the Lane Kiffin?
I have none on that. But we won't know until mid-January for that, because the NFL does have a uniform process for that. But look, I just think Ole Miss is having its best season in decades, maybe ever. And, in the middle of it, you've got his family going to visit places. And look, if your dad is up for a job, it's not unreasonable to go look at the city if it's going to uproot the entire family or if it's going to have consequences down the road. But it's why is this happening in the middle of a season that he's pledged, his total, undivided commitment to, and gotten a bunch of really good players to buy into that also? To me, that's the part where it gets really, frankly, disgusting.
Yeah, it's tough. All right. Well, are you working on anything else? We got any profiles you got coming up? Any investigations?
No, I wish I could. As you can't tease investigations. But I think I've got some good stuff that fans in sports and beyond sports will really enjoy reading. About a year ago, January, my Frankwick, colleague Don Van Natta, we co-write a lot of stories together. But we did that big story about Dan Snyder and how disgusted and turned off he was by the Commander success. And that was a lot of fun because, you know, those stories are just great because they transcend the sports world. And, you know, that hopefully we'll have a couple more, you know, stories that are, you know, that's not about Washington or about Snyder, but hopefully we have some stories that do that soon.
Well, Washington sports fans are thankful for any aid and comfort that was provided on the transfer to the new owner over there. Now that they've political world at least has a football team that they can unite around. Not that good this year, but the trajectory is good. Thanks to Jaden Daniels, and thanks for getting rid of Dan Snyder. Seth Wickersham, thanks so much for doing this. Folks looking for a break from politics, but, you know, some themes, some overlap. You can go check out the book, American Kings. It's out now. It's at your bookstore. You can go get it. A little something to read over the holidays. And we'll be seeing you next time you come through town. All right, man?
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.